Welcome to That Makes Total Sense, a podcast dedicated to exploring God's generosity and justice. I'm Alexis Busetti, a Christian aiming to ask good questions and encouraging you to do the same. Every one of us is wired by God to live out generosity and justice, but the how sometimes eludes us. That Makes Total Sense is a way for us to get together, posture ourselves as learners, and challenge one another to practice generosity and justice in a tangible way every day. Oh my goodness. So my guest and I today have just been laughing because we're trying to get started. We really are, guys, but we're just talking about how many people or animals may or may not walk in. And we're still at the tail end of COVID. This is just real life for Zoom. And so hi, Kitty. We're sitting a few states apart.
Hi, Alexis.
But the same thing's happening in our house.
Yes. Yes. I kind of like it. It's Perfection is underrated.
I mean, overrated. Exactly. Overrated. Yeah. No, I love it. I agree. It's the same thing. This is real life. So I'm sitting with Kitty Murray, and she has an incredible... I want to say an incredible ministry. She has an incredible business called Refuge Coffee in Clarkston, Georgia, which is just outside of Atlanta. We actually got hooked up together to talk today with one of my friends who lives in the Atlanta area. And she just said, oh my goodness, can I please introduce you to Kitty? I think you guys would just hit it off. And I think she'd be great for the podcast. And she was right. So thanks for coming on, Kitty.
Thank you. We haven't had it yet. So hopefully you'll still say that when we're done.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. I will. So I already mentioned that you have a place called Refuge Coffee, and I really, really want to get into, and we'll spend this conversation talking about kind of what you guys do there. But I want to start because you guys serve a refugee community largely in your small town. I mean, this is a small town in Georgia, right?
You would think that. And, but we're actually, I don't know if you've ever been to Atlanta. So Atlanta has 285. It's our perimeter. Inside 285 is mostly urban. Outside is mostly suburban, but you are in Houston, right? So
yeah.
Urban sprawl, So we are really in Atlanta. We're part of Atlanta. We're a half a mile outside of 285, our perimeter. Which is really Atlanta.
Yes. Yes.
There are a lot of other little towns, like I guess most big cities. And Clarkston is 1.4 square miles. There are 13,000 people here. So it's actually the most densely populated city in all of Georgia. So, but all of those are things that are surprising to people in Atlanta. Like if they know that refugees had been resettled in this community since the 80s. And if they don't know the makeup of this little town, Time Magazine called us the most diverse square mile in the country. So, but people often they'll hear about it and think of it as a place that's inaccessible to the rest of the city and far away. And that's not true. So
there you go. Well, thanks for clearing that up. That totally makes sense because we've got some, obviously some, like you said, some suburban cities in and around Houston that are exactly like what you're saying. I mean, like we see the sign on the highway that tells you, now you're entering, right? You're entering Sugarland or Missouri City or Katy or, something like that, but it's all really, you're like, this is Houston.
This is Atlanta.
This is everything here. This kind of runs together. So yeah, thanks for clarifying that. Cause that kind of makes more sense and helps me, kind of picture, when I'm picturing your truck and when I'm picturing the building, it kind of helps me put that in perspective. So, you've already hit on some of the things that were just so wild to me. So the most diverse square mile in the country.
Possibly, Time Magazine said that we've all latched onto it. Actually, I believe it was CNN that purportedly called us the most diverse square mile in the world. Wow. I don't think that can be true, but it is a real, because I live here, and I've lived here now for almost 9 years, it's home, it's normal. I forget, you know, but, mm-hmm. but I was thinking, I was up at our shop, and we do have another shop now. We have one downtown, and we're also opening in the Georgia World Congress Center at the end of the summer. So we've got other places in Atlanta, and because we have coffee trucks, we sort of have a little bit of a presence everywhere in Atlanta, but our home base, is here for sure. And it's where we originated. And I was up at our shop this morning for a few hours, and it was just so interesting to me. There were a group of women that I'm pretty sure they were from the Congo. I don't even know that they bought coffee. They just came to sit and visit and be together, and, you know, moms and a few grandmoms. And then there are a lot of students, and then there are other people in the community. And then there are people that are coming from other parts of Atlanta. And it's just, you know, a really fun mix of people.
I love that. My son's from the Congo, actually. Oh, and so when I was seeing some of this, you know, some of the people that you guys, that are, work at Refuge, you know, and, mm-hmm. and there were, I think in one of the stories, that I got to watch, there was a man who was, Congolese as yes. well. And I was like, oh, this, like, that feels like home to me. Right. Mm-hmm. That he's, mm-hmm. that he's from Congo, where my son is from. So I want to kind of start, like, where did the idea, and you're just living there in your home in one of the most diverse places in the country. Where did the idea for starting a coffee truck and a coffee shop in this way come from?
Huh. Well, you know, I do need to say I am not particularly very linear. So I'm not like a, you know, strategist about life. You know, I'm just used to think I should be, but I am not. So the story is going to feel sort of like an amoeba more than anything. But so my husband and I moved here, and that is actually a really cool story how we ended up here. And it was really him asking me one night, if the Bible talks about widows, aliens, and orphans more than it talks about any other grouping of people, just about. The story of and the idea for Refuge Coffee is really rooted in our reason to be here. We did not move to Clarkston to start anything, like we, or even to be a part of anything necessarily. My husband, one night over dinner, and this is right when we were pretty new empty nesters. So we, you know, or as we like to say, free birds. You know, we had the ability to kind of do whatever we wanted to do. My husband had been a pastor for years. And so we usually chose where we lived, you know, in the community of the church he was serving. And what, he was not in that role anymore either. And so we were kind of able to do whatever. And he worked for a nonprofit ministry. I was writing full time and able to work from home. And so one night he said to me, you know, if the Bible talks about widows, aliens, and orphans, and mentions that group of people, you know, I know it's over 100 times, you know, in other words, those are people who are important to God. They're on his heart. They're top of mind for him. And they're just not on our hearts or on top of mind for us. He goes, why don't we have any friends who fit that description? And I was really defensive. Which is kind of a pattern for me, I think. But, and I was like, well, yeah, we do, you know, and I started listing things we had done and places we had given, you know, not a lot, but we, you know, we'd done some giving and some like projects. And he said, that's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about friendships and relationships. And so for us, we determined that night after I got over my defensiveness that we would buy a house because we were going to buy a house. And then we were living in an apartment downtown for a little season. And we would buy it somewhere that would put us in proximity to not just to a diverse population of people that, you know, were diverse in every way, you know, not just skin color, but economically and all of that. But that would put us in proximity to people with need. And And so that's how we ended up in Clarkston. And we had read When Helping Hurts already. We'd read, there's another book called Toxic Charity. We'd already read that. So we had the idea that we weren't going to swoop in and be like the saviors of the world. And the community didn't need us to do that, nor was that an appropriate way to do life. And we'd had that done to us a few times in just ministry settings, and we knew what it felt like, and we didn't want to do that. Of course, that doesn't mean we did everything perfectly, because we almost immediately, I transgressed in lots of ways when we moved here, because I was just so overwhelmed when we moved here. But we moved in, we got to know our neighbors. This community is over 50%, good bit over 50% foreign born. And most of the people who live here are resettled refugees or immigrants. So, it's just people making their way after massive trauma that wasn't their fault. And so it could just as easily have been us. You know, it's, being a refugee is a circumstance. It's not an identity. And so we moved in and we got to know our neighbors. And, I'm sure this is rooted in my kind of wiring, but one of the things that I kept feeling was, well, I want everybody to know my neighbors. Like, I'm just a kind of a natural networker. When I meet someone that I find delightful or fascinating, I think of two or three other delightful, fascinating people that need to know them. And I think of the magic that can happen, you know, if that happens. So, but it felt like the barrier to that happening was what, you know, I just felt like there was a barrier. A long time ago, even before we moved here, I'd read that 85% of immigrants to our country have never been inside an American home. And so, and which probably means we haven't been inside their homes either. So it felt like there was a need for a more intentional hospitality. So that was the first thing. And I've always loved coffee, and I love coffee shops. I love meeting people in coffee shops. I love doing work in coffee shops. I love the way you can meet and the meeting doesn't have to end at a certain time, and the investment in it doesn't have to be so great as if you do lunch or dinner, you know, because you just bought a cup of coffee. And so I kind of love that. And so the sort of loops of conversation that began in my head after we'd been here a while were, one, you know, we just need a place like that, like, so that we can introduce people to each other and have a place where you get to, you know, decompress, you know. And then as we got to know our community and as we began praying with people and for people, what we started hearing was, well, the job situation is bad. And it is. I mean, our jobless rate was higher than most of the state. And that's not for lack of the will to work or for lack of education often. I mean, sometimes language and education are issues, but not really. I mean, it was mostly just there weren't jobs. And so the number one jobs that refugees are offered when they come here are at the chicken processing plants. They're an hour and a half away. They're the jobs that typically nobody wants, but they're not terrible jobs. But if you come here and you have a family and you want to build a life, to have to commute an hour and a half away, to be in an environment where you don't get to learn English because you're on a line working and not conversing with people, it really is a dead end job for a refugee. And so the other thought was, is there some way to create some jobs? And I don't have any business acumen at all. I might have a little now just because I've been doing this a while, but none. My husband probably has less than me. I mean, we're both more like relational people, and, you know, we're more poets than prose, you know, that's just us. And so anyway, those kind of ideas of could we create jobs, but do it with this kind of fun coffee shop thing, that's kind of how this came about, was just a lot of what if, you know, and could we, and would this truly meet a need? And then eventually my husband said to me, you keep initiating these conversations about this. And I was talking about it to people all the time. Once I felt free to talk about it, took a while, but then I was having all these conversations. And he said, but I think you want someone to take ownership. And he goes, and I don't know that that's going to happen. I think it might need to be you. And so, and it wasn't like, nobody's going to do this, so I will. It was just like an observation that, yeah, this might be your gig, you know, maybe.
Yeah.
So, yeah, that was a long answer, but that's the gist of it.
No, yeah. I'm kind of chuckling to myself because I'm like, some of the things that I'm doing right now are because of those same kinds of conversations where my husband's like, are you sure that's not like your calling or like your thing? And I'm kind of like, I don't really know what you're talking about, you know? And it's like,
I know.
Well, and then here we are, you know? So which came first, the truck or the shop?
Oh, that's a good question, because you're going to see this theme of me not being very smart, but I I'll add another piece to it. The thing I started hearing from people that, well, I own a business and I hired refugees and they didn't know how to blank, blank, blank. And it was often just kind of simple things that are more cultural that had just but it's like, well, how do you expect them to know? There needs to be some level of training. So that idea that an opportunity is great, but if there's no preparedness for that opportunity, it's a setup for failure. So the idea that we would do a coffee shop with, and involve training became really obvious that we needed to do that. But so the idea was like, it sort of took root, and I had maybe 3 pages max, maybe 2, in a journal with ideas. The extent of my business plan was that I drew a coffee cup and it had like 3 levels of something. I don't even remember what it was. And I drew little sketches of chickens on the page because my idea was that, oh, wouldn't it be fun to have a chicken coop at our coffee shop where we could sell our, you know, whatever, use the eggs for our menu. I mean, ridiculous. It has not happened. It probably will never happen. But
you got to start somewhere. You got to have an idea, right? You got to throw something out.
Yes. But I think I can't remember the timeline, but at one point I asked my husband, I said, can we just invite some people over? I would have to be really crass. I'll say some of my rich friends, you know, our friends that have resources, because we really didn't at all. And I couldn't even afford to quit my day job. Like, we needed me to work. But so I was like, let's invite them over. And, you know, I'll serve dinner, I'll get food from some of the local restaurants, and we'll have a dinner, and I'll sort of spin this tale of what I want to do and ask them if they will fund it. And a couple of our sons said, who are smart young men, but they said, Mom, this is a great idea, but you're not ready to ask for money from anybody. And it was a blow. I was like, oh, really? Okay. Well, we've already invited everybody over for dinner. So we have everybody over for dinner. And I since have looked back and seen the wisdom in this, but I didn't ask anybody for money. I just said, hey, I'm thinking of doing this. You are smart people, and they are. What do you think? And so one of those women, one of the couples, she's the one who said, you need to do a coffee truck. And I was like, no. And the reason I didn't was because this element, now I can articulate it better, but this element of placemaking, of I wanted to create a place. And a coffee truck felt like it didn't create a place. Now, a coffee truck would cost, you know, a fourth of what it would cost to set up a coffee shop. And that was, you know, don't bother me with numbers, but that was really true. But what ended up happening, and she even laughs about, she says that she made me cry. I'm not sure I cried. I think I was greatly perplexed, because it was like, wait, I have this momentum of an idea and you've just changed it pretty drastically. And so I'm trying to listen to you, but it's really hard, you know, it's that kind of thing. And it turned out that it not only was it an easier ask to say, hey, we're going to raise money to build out a coffee truck. And then if this whole thing blows up and it doesn't work, we can sell the coffee truck. You know what I mean? It's not, but we did it. I mean, we eventually did it. And it's a longer story than that, obviously, but we set up at the first we had, where there's a guy that owned it used to be a gas station, but for almost 25, 30 years, it had been a used car dealership. His name was Dave, and it's right in the center of the town. It is the perfect location. I also had another location in mind that now I know would have been terrible, but I was really sold on that other location. But he allowed us to use his parking lot, and his parking lot was right there on the main light in town, the main drag in town. And he let us use the front half of his parking lot for $1 a month. We painted a big sunflower on the asphalt, and that was our patio. We had 2 tents and a bunch of IKEA tables and chairs. And 2 days a week, we would set up and create this little kind of ersatz coffee shop. And then the other days, if we could get people to agree, we catered. And, you know, the people that helped us at the very beginning, some of which are still around, just worked so hard. But so that was our coffee shop from May to about, I think, October of 2015. And then the guy that owned that space decided to retire, and he cleared out his whole space and let us use the whole thing. And that eventually became our coffee shop. We eventually bought it. We still don't have a coffee bar or kitchen inside. Our first truck, we have other trucks now, but our first truck is our coffee bar. So you order outside, but there's a huge indoor space. It's about a quarter of an acre. So it's a pretty big lot, lots of room for people to gather. So, but when That's it started, amazing. Like it was, you know, that summer, it was just brutally hot under those tents. And then if it rained, you know, it was just miserable. But that's how it started. Yeah. But let me just say one more thing. So to kind of tie a bow on the story, you know, I didn't want to do it that way. I wanted to do it another way. I wanted to build community. Well, what that did was we didn't have windows. We didn't have doors. We didn't have any impediment to anybody walking up to our space. And we were right up against the sidewalk. Across the street is a train track. So, you know, it was so loud. But anyway, we would, we'd literally go up to people who were walking by, and if they didn't speak English, we'd try to explain, hey, we'll buy you a cup of coffee. You know, you want to try a latte? You want to try a chai tea, you know, whatever. And, the truck was brilliant. I mean, it was brilliant. And it is, I mean, we're a nonprofit, so about half of our income comes from donations, but a big part of our income doesn't come from coffee shops because they don't make that much money. It comes from our catering, which the truck has enabled us to do. Right. Yeah.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
I'm kind of, I've got some questions spinning in my head, but I want to start with, so you've got this population of people who have fled their countries, are largely foreign born. And as you said, like the kind of the normal, I would say like maybe the path that is tread with this people in this circumstance is you come and you're resettling here, and then you're going to work in a factory somewhere or, you know, in some plant far away. So how did you... The word that's coming to my mind is advertise. Like, how did you advertise? Hey, we have jobs. This is going to be a different, you know, kind of space. Like, how did you start to kind of reroute some of that well-worn path inside of the community that you really wanted to serve?
Yeah. You know, that's a really good question. And I would say, and that is part of the nuance of what we do, because if we're going to be a coffee shop that makes any money, we have to, and engages people outside of Clarkston, we had to market out there. So we had to do, and of course we didn't have money, so we have to do it on social media and through friends. And, you know, I sent a text to a group of friends this morning about an event we're doing that's very low key, not an official event. This morning I was like, I haven't done this in a long time. Like, we don't do it that way anymore, but it was very, very grassroots, just us, you know. But there was also word of mouth. So, and this is interesting. And one of our staff members reminded me of this. So my husband and I led a small group from our church. It was just at our house. And lead is a funny word. We didn't really lead it much. Like, there were all these young people, couples and a few singles that really led it. We were just there for them and to encourage them. But the group got really big. Like, at some point it was, if everybody was in our house, it'd be like 60 people. And our house isn't that big. And not everybody was there every week. But that group, everybody was rooted in this community in one way or another. And so that group became kind of our volunteer muscle, our word of mouth muscle. And they weren't the only ones. There were other ways that people got the word out. So when we were ready to hire our first barista trainee, you know, we didn't know what we were doing. And so we got the word out to people we knew in the community. And Leon Shambana, who is from the Congo, had been to our house for the small group. He'd been a few times. And so we knew him, but somebody else on our staff knew him even better and invited him to, it said, do you want to, and he worked at the chicken plant. We laughed because he still works for us. And he was like, it was an adventure. And I did not know if I would have a job, you know, in 6 months. And none of us knew, you know, but he kind of signed on and we were able to pay him, you know, equivalent to what he was making. And so he is now our, what is his title? Our our customer experience director. So he's amazing. But so really, I would say the first year and a half or two, and we didn't hire that many people right off the bat, but it was mostly word of mouth. And Leon tells the story. He was living in an apartment. He'd been here from the Congo. He came about a year after Bill and I did to the community. He lived in an apartment complex, and we had a staff member, a part-time staff member who lived, was his neighbor. And another neighbor's apartment flooded, and they met as they were helping this neighbor, like, move all her furniture out. And so from then on, they've just been friends. So
that's really sweet.
Yeah. And Leon, I'll just say Leon, I mean, he showed up 20 minutes early for the interview. You know, a crisp white shirt and, you know, navy pants, and like, so eager to just work hard. And his story at the time, he was here alone. He had children in the Congo that were missing, and you know, that, and that's actually, we know two other families who got here, and just everybody gets separated when in a civil war and there's so much violence, and people would want to hear his story and he didn't want to talk about it. It was way too painful. And it's current, you know, just because that happened in the past doesn't mean you know, we have a lot of people from Eritrea and Ethiopia right now. Well, you know, I'm always asking them, is your family okay? Or is everybody safe? Because, you know, there's so many places in those countries that are at the moment still not safe or stable. So Leon, eventually he married, he has several children with his beautiful wife, Faraha, but his two of his children are now here, but they found, an aid worker found them. And so, you know, we've gotten to be kind of in that story with him, and it's still hard for him to talk about some of it. And so to try to honor that, yeah, it's important.
Yeah. I mean, it's incredibly important. And I just think, like, having, you know, one of the things that was provided for him, you know, through refuge was just, I'm just thinking about the stress or the time commitment and things like that of just being able to not commute, you know, to be kind of grounded, you know, in this space with people whom he already knew, you know, and was going to be able to have this relational, you know, tie with, you know, his job. I'm just like, that's what we all want, right? Like that's what, you know, that's the kind of thing, you know, that we want, and to be able to kind of provide some of those intangibles, for people who their, you know, parts of their life are really in disarray or really traumatic, to be able to have some relational and occupational stability at the same time. It's just huge, you know, it's just
to be able to breathe.
Yeah,
to breathe. Exactly. Yeah. And then to dream, because I would say the, you know, not all, but many refugees have been in a really hard holding pattern for years, like years. We have one employee who was in a past employee who was, let me think about this, Ethiopian, but was in a camp in Kenya for 18 years of his life, you know? And so dreaming meant just getting out, you know, and that's about it. And so once you're here, you have to have a pause, you know? And I feel like that when refuge works best, it works when it is that for someone where they get to work and contribute, because our barista trainees are very much a part of this mission of welcoming people, all people. But they also get to breathe and not be under a ton of stress. And that's why it was important for us to have their wages not be something that would require them to get another job, you know?
So I'm wondering if you'll talk about kind of these three aspects of refuge and what you guys do with the mentorship. So we've touched on the job training some, and really the community support. That was kind of my biggest question, is how do you provide this community, you know, support, for the people who are working at refuge, but you've got kind of these three aspects that you guys have kind of braided together, in what you're doing in your business model of mentorship and job training and community support. So can you just maybe give us some examples or touch on each of those three things and how they work to do what you guys are doing?
I'll try. I will say it sounds, and you know, I do think, somebody asked me yesterday when I was talking to a group of like nonprofit founders. No, it wasn't even that group. It was a different group, but somebody said, were you ever nervous that it wouldn't work? And I was like, are you kidding me? I still feel that way. And I will say the reason it works is because all of those things that you mentioned, I don't really know how to do. Like I don't, but we have people that we either partner with or who we employ now as we're able to, you know, beef up our actual team, who are so good at that. And so, and we're all committed to the same basic core values, but what they're able to do is I'm blown away. So, and when we first started, you know, job training, like I laugh about it now. And I think about, friends for life, the people that we started this with that are like, they were in it with us. And, a young woman named Jessica, who now lives in Texas. I'm just missing her so much, but she was, I think, 21 or 22. And, she was willing to help raise some of her own support. We've never done that since, but we did that for her first year, because we didn't have the money to pay her. And she was our job trainer. And I had no doubt that she knew how to care for people, that she knew how to dignify people, that all the important things she knew. But she didn't know what job training was supposed to look like. And so we used a job training program that we had found online, and it was great. And then we've added people over the years who have just really built out this very robust job training program. And it makes me dizzy to look at all of it sometimes, but it is. So I would say we do job training. And it's, we're always building it based on what people's needs are also. And then mentorship, of course, during COVID, that almost was impossible because it just needed to be hands-on. And so we're building that back in. And then the community support, that's the part that is the messiest and sloppy, but sloppy because it's not our main thing. And so, but because we, again, this, it all feels very like, oh, we stumbled around. And I hate even saying it that way because it sounds like everybody stumbles and they don't. I feel like I'm the one that probably does the most, but the, I think just figuring out what that's supposed to look like as things happen. So I'll give you a couple of examples. So we, and I think I'll, anyway, yeah. I think we were 2 years in. We have a good friend. He and his wife are both cardiologists, one from Syria, one from Iraq. They're both Kurdish. They're amazing people. He called me and he said, hey, you might not have known this, but the White House isn't hosting an iftar dinner this year. It's first time in years, decades. And an iftar is the dinner during Ramadan that Muslims break their fast. It's an every night thing. My husband and I went to one at our local mosque a few weeks ago. And it's, you know, usually in people's homes at sundown. And he said, what can we do? Like, he said, our Muslim community here is, we're not angry, but we are sort of hurt. And as you know, this was a time when anti-Muslim sentiment was super high. And so we decided to host an iftar dinner, and we had a week to plan it. It was a potluck. It was crazy timing. We probably, our team just said, how can we not do this? Let's do it. Even though we really didn't have the capacity to do it. We did it anyway. And I'm so proud of the whole community. So we probably had about 250 people show up. Wow. We invited the imam to come and do the call to prayer before dinner. And, you know, there were parts of it that we didn't do right. Like our friend, and he's Muslim, but he announced, you know, if you're Muslim, grab one of your non-Muslim friends to go through the line with you. Well, the problem with that was the non-Muslims had not fasted and they weren't hungry. and so there were a few people there who were kind of hangry, like, wait, why are you doing that? So the next year we didn't do it that way. But so I would say, because Refuge is, you know, we're not an advocacy group. We're not an aid agency. We don't, just not all those things. But we have freedom because we have space, you know, and we're all about just making people feel welcome. And so we've been able to be kind of fluid and open up our space to invite people in at kind of the right time. You know, when COVID started, someone came to me and said, can we set up a food pantry? Like just a free, like the little free libraries, but make it food. And we will buy the cabinet, we'll install it, and we'll write all the different languages on it. And I thought, oh, that's kind of cool. And is that, my question is always, because of what we do, is this really meaningful? Like, it feels a little fluffy. It feels very much like just a surface fix. You know, there are food pantries, there are food distribution groups. Is this going to do anything? Well, shocker, like, it became so helpful in our community. And then we eventually, like, it was clearing out every few days. We eventually partnered with a group that, I mean, they brought a Sub-Zero fridge and this, you know, all these volunteers to keep up with it because it had become kind of a logistical nightmare. And it's still there. And it, meets a need. We're not the only ones dealing with food insecurity, because there are lots of other groups doing it way smarter than we are, but we're doing it in a way that feels like there's no shame in it. You just show up. And I'll see people there all the time, and I don't know if they're there getting food out or putting food in. It doesn't matter, you know? And so I think that's what community support looks like. And we do it, we work to do it. We don't do it perfectly. We work to do it with our community, not for our community. Like, that's a big deal to me. And I mess up in that way all the time, because it's really easy when you're the one with the resources to sort of do that in a way that feels like we're going to win for you, you know, and that's not what we want to do.
Yeah. So. I feel like that theme has been one that has been, it's been showing up a lot for me in mm-hmm. conversation and in things I'm studying and people that I'm speaking with. And it's kind of one of those things you're like, okay, now I'm realizing every time I see a red Honda, right? It's like, I'm constantly hearing this. And you know, some examples I have, where I was talking with, a pastor for the show, Lamar Hardwick, who was, he was diagnosed as being on the autism spectrum. And so he wrote a book about, ministering with people with disabilities, right? As mm-hmm. the largest marginalized group in the world. Mm-hmm. And really works hard to make that distinction in the ministry of, we're not ministering to this people group. We really want to be sure that we're ministering with this people group, right? And another author I had on, who does some amazing work in Nashville with people who are experiencing homelessness, right? And it's like, we're not doing this on like a social worker client kind of level. We're doing this like in a mutually relational level, right? Where we really are just trying to build relationships and friendships with people that we meet and with people who we really do want to serve, but we are recognizing like all of our humanity and all of our dignity and working together and with and in these mutual mm-hmm. partnerships. And when I hear you saying the same kind of thing, I mean, it's kind of like, okay, God, you know, like I'm listening, but you know, I just think it just really does. Even before we started, we were having some conversation about just community, you know, this mm-hmm. beloved community that God is putting together in us. And it's like, it just makes us recognize, I may be able to give something in a space, and that is, it's, I can be really generous because I am able to, I have this resource, whatever it is, time, space, money, you know, whatever. But I can also receive, because there are definitely places where I have deficit that other people have surplus, right? And they can be generous. Mm-hmm. And to be able to receive and have this reciprocal mutual relationship with our neighbors and with our friends is really beautiful. And I think part of it is kind of looking for those ways to do that aren't, you know, kind of what we're used to, you know, like, well, I have money, so I'll donate this, or I have time, so I'll donate this, or whatever. But just, you know, kind of recognizing like what each of us has that we can really be generous. And then recognizing, you know, those places in ourselves where we really could benefit.
I think it's also, you know, it's, this is so simple, and it's taken me years and years to kind of begin to see it. But if, and I might step on toes when I say this, but I can say it because I am,
we're here for it.
I'm in church. I love the church. But I think church as an institution and as a local organization can often suck up all our time and energy and our gifts. And it doesn't mean we shouldn't give those gifts to the church, our time, energy, and our talents and all that. But I do think we should consider not only giving them to the church, so that, because I think blessing our communities is our mandate, you know, as sojourners, as refugees on earth, you know, we're called to bless the communities we live in. And I think this idea that, if I give it all to the church and I'm totally worn out. And so I don't have time to go to my neighbor's son's soccer game or to have dinner with, you know, the person I work with or to spend any time. It's a stark example, but before we moved to Clarkston, we lived in an apartment community and we were in a space in our lives, Bill and I were, where we just had more time than we had had forever. And we were not, he was not on staff at a church. So, which was very new to us. Like that's kind of what we'd always done. And so we, in our apartment community, I started a running club. So just, and I'm the slowest runner on earth, but I would get out and run. And so then we started training for an Atlanta half marathon, a group of us. And on the day of the half marathon, I was just with my neighbors, you know, and there in our corral, there was a group of from some church that had a running club. So it was a Christian running club and they had bright, beautiful shirts that said, "I can do all things through Christ who strengthens me," which is a kind of less than interpretation of that verse. But you know, I get it. That thing of, oh, let's just do a lot of fun stuff and invite people to it and tell them this is church stuff. And then somehow, you know, whatever else you do with that, that model, I just think is feels disingenuous to me now. And doesn't mean I'm not judging it, but I am saying, should we consider different things? So I think for me, the helpful thing is to go, okay, what do I do? What do I like to do? Well, maybe I should do it with a diverse group of people, or I should do it with people who, I don't know, who like to do it too. So, I have a friend here in Clarkston from Somalia. Her name is Amina. She lost her husband and all 10 of her children in Somalia. She is an amazing woman who kind of recycles her own trauma into helping other people, sometimes to the detriment of her own health. So as a friend, one day I just said to her, this is before Refuge, "I know you love cappuccinos. Let's go get a cappuccino together." And we went about 5 miles away to a cool little coffee shop in Decatur, which is, you know, another one of those little urban city areas. And we're sitting there drinking our coffee and just chatting. And she goes, "Kitty, there's just never going to be anything like this in Clarkston." And I always tell people she speaks 9 languages and she victim is not one of those. So she was just making an observation. And I asked her, you know, what do you mean? And she said, "Well, nobody believes the refugee community is worth an investment in this." And that idea that we will invest in our own entertainment and comfort and things that are just basic life amenities for ourselves. And refugees can eventually do that and do that. There's some of the most hospitable, gracious, good cooks, good coffee makers I've ever met live right here. But the resources to do that on a scale of like a coffee shop or what we do at Refuge now just might not be there. And so that was this huge tipping point moment for me. Like, wait, maybe instead of pouring all our resources into our own lives, maybe the Bible says we should give those things away, you know, and we should, not see them as our own anyway, and not claim them as our own.
So I'm like, maybe it's because I'm sitting with someone who self-identifies as a networker that all of these other connections are are kind of coming to my mind. But I have a book recommendation because another guest that I had at the podcast on the podcast, her name is Linda McGibbon, and she wrote a book called My Vertical Neighborhood. And she also lived in an apartment complex in Canada. And one of the things that she said that really struck me about her story was when she had moved. So she not only moved into this new apartment building, but it was in a new city in a new part of the country. So everything was new to her at the same time. And part of her story was that she went to her pastor at her new church home and basically said, hey, like, I love it here. I'm proud, you know, I'm happy to be a part of this community. I just want to let you know that I'm making a change in my life, basically. And that if you don't see me on Sundays, it's not because I don't want to be here or something like that. It's because I'm making space for my neighbors.
Yeah.
And for the people who, that actually live very, very close to me in proximity. Mm-hmm. And so she was doing exactly like what you're talking about, saying there's not anything wrong per se with this stuff, right? This kind of church stuff that we do, but what would happen, right? It's kind of an experiment for some of us, right? What would happen if we just loved the people who lived right next to us, mm-hmm. right? Or who we shop mm-hmm. with in the store? What would happen if we loved the people that we were really in proximity with? And I love even kind of like coming back to that beginning part of your story. It's like, and being intentional about putting yourself in proximity, right? Mm-hmm. With people that, you know, God really recognizes are in situations in their life when they really need to feel the love of God.
Yeah. You know,
people who have been widowed and orphans and refugees, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, these are people, like you said, it's not their identity. It's a circumstance. And God tells us over and over and over in scripture, when you meet someone who is in this circumstance, I'm letting you know ahead of time, they need to feel my love, right? They need to feel it from you, because that's a really tangible way they can feel it.
Yeah. Yeah. That's so good. Yeah. I love the book recommendations. That's great. Yeah. I think one of the journey for me has been even, you know, I think it's, all of these things are true. They're true whether we experience them or know them or not. And so one thing that is true is this is, I might be misusing this term, but just the theology of common grace I don't know that anybody ever said this to me. I don't know how I drew these conclusions, but I think I know, but I actually believed, like, I remember hearing a pastor say, Christians are the only people who can love, like, you know, sort of and this is so not true. Like, and so as I kind of got outside of that bubble, that sort of subculture of Christianity, not the church necessarily in its true form, but just that subculture, I began to see how untrue that was and how God is, you know, the rain falls on all of us, you know, and we all get to grow things in that rain. And so I think that's one thing that happens is I began to even have, I had a short little period where I was like, oh God, what do I even have to offer? Like, is the gospel really good news? Yes, it is. Yes, it is. Like, I know it is, but do these people need it any more than I need it? No. Like, there's a commonality in not only our beauty, but in our brokenness. And so I think that, and instead, I think this narrative that, those people, whether you're looking at it politically or racially or even spiritually, those people are out to get what's ours, or those people are out to get our stuff, you know. And I remember the first time I saw the bumper sticker, the coexist bumper sticker, you know, I had an anger born of a fear, you know, like, no. And that's, that bumper sticker doesn't say co-believe all these things. It just says coexist, and we do exist. And what better way to exist than to love and give each other grace? So, yeah, that's been a journey for me. And it's a journey that I don't think could have happened without some amount of experience. So I used to say, oh, you don't need to move like we did, because that is dumb. Not everybody needs to move zip codes, you know, but I do think there needs to be movement, like embodiment of what we believe. If we believe that the stranger matters to God, then maybe we should seek out the stranger some, you know? And if we believe that nothing we own is ours, but it's His, then maybe we should start like using the things that feel like ours that way, you know. And obviously the standard of goodness and holiness and generosity that is God is so high. So obviously we're not all going to do it to that standard, but I think there's so much joy and freedom found in looking towards who he is and how he is with us and then replicating that to others.
Well, I think you hit on something.
A little, sorry.
I'm glad. Yeah. And I think, I mean, I would say as a Green Seminary student, I feel like you used Common Grace theologically appropriately.
So. Oh, good. I worry about that.
One of my professors is from the Reformed tradition. And so we had a little lecture on that not long ago. And so I would say, I think you nailed it. If it means anything coming from me.
Yes.
But I think that you hit on something with that Common Grace, and it kind of goes back to a little bit of that mutuality, right, that we were talking about earlier, because I would say my experience in kind of the subculture inside, you know, the greater church, inside the subculture that I grew up in, I heard and was taught and believed really similar things, right? Mm-hmm. You know, and it kind of had these kind of weird formulas to how did you get there? But the bottom line answer kind of being it's us, like we're the ones who are capable of love. And, But this theology of common grace teaches us like you said, that's just not true, right? But you know, there's more to it than that. Of there is this rain falling on all of us, like you're talking about, and that we are all created in God's image,
right.
And so as image bearers, we all experience, right, these things that God has put inside of us, like the ability to love, right, and the desire to hope and to help and to self-sacrifice and to be kind and generous, and all of these aspects that are part of God's character at large. We're made in his image, right? And so he's created us with these things as well. And so it is saying, when I'm going to seek out the stranger, because God is saying this is really important. And at the same time, I'm saying, but I'm not seeking out someone who can be a recipient of my charity because I'm better or I have it all together or one of these other things that's not true about me or any Christian, you know. Let's enter into this thing, you know, together. It makes me think about one of the most, I'm now picturing 10 commandments in my head. So we're going to go way back to Charlton Heston, but I'm kind of picturing these scenes. But one of my favorite word pictures in the Bible is when God is about to rescue the people of Israel from their enslavement in Egypt. And there's some wording in there that we know that there are people who attached themselves to the Israelites in those moments. They were the mixed multitudes, is what some translations call it, right? And that they moved with Israel as they exited Egypt, right? And I think this was this mutual relationship where Israel said, our God's coming, right? And they said, we want to know him. We want out to, right? But then they go together and they journeyed together, and they had different things that they were offering one another, no doubt, but they were on this journey of rescue and reconciliation together. These, you know, people groups who didn't have religion in common, really, you know, or heritage in common, really, or homeland in common, really. But they bound themselves up with each other in the rescue of God and in the love of God, and decided to move together and bind themselves up, you know, with each other. And we see it with Ruth, and, you know, some, now you're
just
getting
thinking
me,
of Ruth. Yeah, I know.
We're just going to preach at each other.
But
you know, I just
That's
think
beautiful.
How beautiful that is, you know, and that, we have opportunity to engage in that kind of relationship, you know, and it may not look like a coffee shop. No doubt it won't look like a coffee shop for a lot of us, right? But what does it look like, right? It can look like a lot of different things for our different contexts and where we are.
Right. And we're all in different stages of life. Like I always think about when I first heard really had my eyes open to the to human and sex trafficking, you know, and I feel like it was when a lot of people in the church were going, wait a minute, this is happening, and it's happening in our cities, on the streets in front of our churches, like what's happening? And I remember that feeling of, I have to do something. And I tend to be an I have to do something person, which is good and bad. And I didn't know what to do. And, you know, I'm not really good at activism. That's just not good at it. I appreciate people who are. I'm not, you know, we didn't have a lot of money to give at the time. I didn't. So that I wasn't able to do that. I kept just saying, what can I do? And I ended up, our church, we just used our church basement, and we threw a dinner for the police officers who were in that, you know, in Atlanta, to thank them. And we actually, there were two departments that really viewed this issue very differently, so it was good to have them in the same room. But there was really no agenda other than, hey, we just want you to know we're praying for you, we care about you, we appreciate the work you're doing. It was the closest I could get to it at the time. It was very one-off. I'm not sure it was that effective in any way, but I do think, oh, that's kind of my thing that I do well, that I've never thought was a big deal. Like I used to tell my husband, you have meetings with people and you change the world, and I bake the brownies for those meetings. And like, just really denigrated that. Like, just, you know, that was a little of me, my brand of feminism, complaining about the fact that I baked the brownies. But I actually love baking the brownies. Like, I love that part of what it means to love people. And it isn't very impressive, but that's okay, because it's my way, and it's just doing things my way, you know? And so I think what is beautiful is this thing that if we'll just kind of listen to God, love people, do what he tells us to do the best we know how, like, it, who knows where it'll go? I mean, that's oversimplifying, but, I do think if we get focused on a cause instead of just the simple love of other people, the cause will become, it's easy to weaponize causes. It's easy to use causes to separate people rather than unite them. And so, yeah, anyway, I'm rambling now, but that, I do think it's, I love it when I see somebody come fully alive because they're doing what they're really good at and what they really enjoy, and they're doing it in a redemptive way. You know, that's just Amen. A beautiful thing.
Yeah. Amen. I do too. And it came up for me earlier in our conversation in a different part, but, you know, kind of back to what you were talking about just now, it's like, I think there are some times when I think it was when you were talking about the bringing in the food pantry, you know, but it's like, there are some times when our gifts and our talents and the things that we have to offer, sometimes we end up discounting them because they come easily to us, or, you know, whatever it is. And we don't really realize what an impact that can have on someone else. And I think that sometimes we discount our own, you know, yes. our own gift, what we could do, because we think, oh, anybody could do that, or that's so easy, or whatever. Yeah. And if you get some people around you who can encourage you, who are different than you, then they can say, actually, no, you know, particular thing that you do, like, you couldn't pay me enough money to do that. You know, like, really, I could do that in 15 minutes on a Saturday night and I wouldn't even care. You know, like, no, you know, and I think, again, it's, you know, that beauty of all of us working together. Well, Kitty, I have just enjoyed our time together so much. I want to ask you, what is the best way for people to connect with Refuge and kind of just see the work that you guys are doing, meet some of the people? Where can we find you in online spaces if we're not in Georgia?
Yeah. Okay. I would say the best place is our website. It's refugecoffeeco.com. Refuge.coffee works too, but refugecoffeeco.com. And at the top, when you open the website, there'll be a way to sign up for our emails. We don't send a ton of them, but those are really a good way to sort of get up to date on current things. It's sort of where I process. So sometimes, but hopefully for the benefit of others, but So I would say that's the first place. We're on social media and it's at Refuge Coffee Co. everywhere. If you're local, obviously come see us in one of our places. This eventually will happen. We're about to finish a fundraising campaign to develop our own roasting program. So eventually you'll be able to buy Refuge Coffee online. Yeah, that's just not happening yet. But when it's time, we would love it if you would do that. But so that's really it. I would say those are the main ways. The website, social media, come see us.
Amazing. Yeah. Well, your apparel is super cute too. I mean, super cool. I kind of checked out the shop today, but when I was looking, my husband was like, well, what about the coffee? I'm like, I don't know. I don't think they roast. And so, man, I'm pumped about that. We will first on the list to order a pound. I'm so excited about that. We're coffee lovers at our house. So we'll put all of the links to everything that you just mentioned in the show notes for today's episode so that people can connect with you at Refuge. Great. Thanks for coming on, Kitty.
Oh, thank you. What a pleasure. I'm so sorry we don't live where we can go get a cappuccino together.
I mean, but if I'm ever in Atlanta, I'll look you up.
Oh, please. Yeah, we'd love it. I'd love it.
Thanks, Kitty. Thank you.
Take care.
The links for all the resources mentioned in today's episode can be found in the show notes. Music and podcast production by Seth Busetti. Be sure to give us a review on iTunes and subscribe at your favorite podcast listening app. You can also visit us at thatmakestotalsense.com.